Over the past 2 years, Drs. Jamie Wagman and Julia Dower from St. Mary's College collected local stories of those impacted by the worldwide COVID-19 pandemic. The people who shared their experiences present a wide-ranging view of the ways our community worked and sometimes didn't work to protect people's lives. Last year, Drs. Wagman and Dower gave public presentations with clips from some of the narrators who graciously shared their stories. They did it again this past September at the St. Joseph County Public Library with new narrators sharing a different set of stories. We shared the first presentation as a special on this feed last year, and we're doing so again now. The full versions of these oral histories are preserved and accessible through the Civil Rights Heritage Center's archives, and today we share the most recent public presentation. I hope they're as compelling to you as they were to me. Here they are.
Welcome and thanks for joining us. I'm Julia Dower, a professor in the English department at St. Mary's College, and I'm excited to join my colleague Jamie Wagman in presenting this program. In recent weeks, as we've transitioned from a hot summer into a hectic fall, and COVID-19 cases have ticked up locally and across the country, I have been returning to an early pandemic comfort, Samin Nasrat and Rishi Hirway's podcast, Home Cooking, which they began to offer advice for those cooking at home under stay-at-home orders in 2020. Re-listening to the podcast has the feeling of opening a time capsule, listening back through the pandemic as it unfolded. This makes it especially interesting to consider alongside the oral histories from which today's program is drawn. I have arrived at the Thanksgiving 2020 episodes of Home Cooking and was especially struck by these comments from the show's hosts. Samin says, "I think it's a tough year. It's a different year. This is going to be a year that we look back on at the end of our lives and remember always as just a year that was different. And it's okay if this meal is different. I don't think anybody's meal is going to look normal." Rishi says, "Yeah, the whole year has an asterisk, so your Thanksgiving can too." Looking back from 2020, I'm still comforted by these comments, but they also seem at odds with the realities of remembering the pandemic from here, in the oral histories we have collected, and in our collective consciousness. The whole year might have had an asterisk, but the memory of it is less present and less sharp for many than we might have anticipated. This observation that remembering the COVID-19 pandemic is a piecemeal and challenging task for many Americans also leads me to consider the particular narrative forms we do continue to associate with the pandemic, publicly and privately. In her book, Contagious, Cultures, Contagion, and the Outbreak Narrative, Priscilla Wald writes about the ways U.S. culture has told stories about novel illnesses across the 20th century and into the 21st century. Wald outlines what she calls the outbreak narrative to describe the ways novel contagious diseases are spoken and written about in U.S. culture. "We saw many elements of the outbreak narrative, this way of speaking about illness, unfolding in real time in the early phases of COVID-19, including through xenophobic rhetoric, an emphasis on borders, and a focus on scientific innovation as a path to resolution. But we saw something more as well, as Wald and others have noted. We saw a focus on systemic inequality, public health funding, and community care, all of which outbreak narratives can sometimes minimize or obfuscate. This focus on inequity and care seems like it might lead to larger structural changes in public health practice and healthcare in the U.S. and beyond. Now, in 2023, with the suffering, isolation, and innovation of 2020 at a remove from the present, public health advocates worry that a concerted effort to improve public health care and counter inequity is fading across the U.S., even as COVID-19 continues to impact our communities And as experts anticipate, other novel illnesses are likely to emerge. We invite you to listen today to stories about COVID-19 in our community with a focus on how we remember, the stories we tell, and the ways the pandemic in all its phases continues to resonate in your life and community.
Thank you, Julia. And this is Jamie Wagman, Professor of Gender and Women's Studies and History. Sometimes remembering is an act of rebellion, an upheaval of power, a will to say, it was like this. No, it was like this. No, this is the way it was. Psychiatrist Mark Epstein, who writes about trauma, says that trauma is not just the result of major disasters. It does not only happen to some people. An undercurrent of trauma runs through ordinary life. Our world is unstable and unpredictable and operates to a great degree and despite incredible scientific advancement, outside our ability to control it. If trauma happens to everyone in every ordinary life, then it would make sense to claim that we all experienced collective trauma during 2020. Death hung over us in an unstable world, even more so than usual. And this collective trauma also affected the way people were able to think and remember and process emotions and experience. Our South Bend Pandemic Oral History Project documents, preserves, and interprets local residents' stories and memories. When we first interviewed South Bend residents in 2022, raw pain was closer to the surface for many people who spoke candidly about fear and loss, combing the grocery store aisles for baby thermometer batteries, being afraid of one another in stores, being afraid for one's life and one spouse's health, and feeling utterly alone and desolate. Stories came pouring out of people, out of a need to finally speak and share their memories. The experience for students 1 year later differed. Some interviewees still expressed extreme stress and despair in processing loss of a parent or fear as their place of work closed in 2020. Some also expressed difficulties remembering, as though a curtain had been drawn, challenging their memory and narrative as they tried to express a timeline of their lives. Of course, memory is not always accurate. As Annette Cohn, who writes about memory, suggests, it's a position, a point of view, in the current moment on the past, not necessarily an archive. And our point of view shifts, and at times is influenced by our mood, the day we're having, and who is interviewing us. Students interviewed 22 South Bend residents the last 2 years, training to learn the art of oral history interviewing, and then going out on their own, at times accompanied by me, to interview. Faculty-student research in the best of times varies as students grapple with new lessons and try to see themselves as working historians and storytellers. While I accompanied students to interviews and occasionally interjected a question or two, students do this work without constant correction and follow-up, allowing them to learn from missed moments and opportunities. We only ever have that moment to press an issue, give interviewees more space and silence to process and remember. And then the moment is gone. Oral history is always rife with missed opportunities. In the following 25-minute audio session, we highlight clips from audio interviews with South Benders about their recollections of what happened in the spring of 2020 and beyond, how they lived through the pandemic in South Bend, what they remember, and how their lives and outlooks changed. While their memories are at times muddled from having lived through trauma, they are also still processing and making sense of their memories, what scared them, what changed them, and what they think of it all now, 3 years later. How we remember the COVID-19 pandemic. Reflections from a South Bend Oral History Project. Struggling to remember.
We did not leave South Bend until, I think it was August of 2020. Mm-hmm. I don't think we traveled that summer. Maybe we did. I don't remember. I don't think we did. I think it was August before we left because we had the house we were working on.
I really felt at that point it was the only safe way to have my dad over because we still were so worried about because we didn't even have the tests at first. Remember, you had to go stand in the line to get the test and, you know, to make an appointment, and you had to drive them in the middle of nowhere, and you had to stand in these lines of social to get the tests. And so who's going to do that every week to see if you have COVID or not?
We finally had our first in-person gathering as women priests in the region when we had a retreat in September of 2021, and that's when Mary Frances had been elected, excuse me, but we had our first retreat at that time, and then Mary Frances was ordained a bishop in 2022. I think that's how it was. No, I remember now. I think this is a consequence of COVID. Even though I never had COVID, the whole experience is that I get slowed down and I see others that get slowed down.
Yeah, I mean, we used, now I'm not remembering the program, but we actually uploaded our videos and things through another electronic portfolio thing. And so we learned that as well. But generally it was like most of the communication was through Zoom because it was so hard because there was so much to talk about. And then if you can't just talk on the phone and text and email, all that stuff.
Remembering uncertainty.
The uncertainty is what I remember most. That you just couldn't rely on anything being certain. And that was terrifying in a way. I think in hindsight, we all saw it as this kind of moment, but really it was 2 years. And for the theater, you know, closer to three, really, where the impact was profound. You know, we still, during that time, did a couple virtual things. You know, we had virtual Santa visits. You know, we had some, what did we call them? Singing telegrams, where we'd have people in masks go to someone's yard and sing to them. Oh. You know, we had a lot of kids stuff where we had Zoom theater, things like that. I remember we had a Halloween event where, you know, it was just silly individual things like someone getting blood poured on them and me getting trapped in a coffin and just the stupid stuff, right? But just to make people laugh and to stay relevant. But those 5 months were awful. And again, not knowing what was coming. Luckily, our donors, our supporters, continued to support the theater financially. So we actually went into 21 in pretty good shape. But then in 21, we brought everybody back. But it was still a crazy time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I took everything very seriously, always wore a mask. Everyone that I knew always wore a mask to everything. We never went anywhere unless we absolutely had to. I remember a period of time where my mom, she would go to the grocery store and bring the groceries home and then wipe them down with Clorox wipes, like cartons of eggs with like Clorox wipes, because we didn't know how it spread. But in that, like, we enforced that just generally, and then in the hospital with masking policies and all of that, I mean, like I said, it changed all the time. So every single day we would walk in and we'd be like, okay, what's the policy today? What are we doing? Are we wearing N95s? Do we have respirators? For a long time, they wouldn't let any of us, not wouldn't let, they discouraged us from wearing makeup so that we could reuse N95s. We would wear surgical scrubs instead of wearing our own scrubs home. We would even like change multiple times. You'd wear surgical scrubs and then you'd change into different street clothes before you went home. And then you'd change in your garage before you went into the house, like strip in your garage and then walk into your house and go and take a shower right away. I know people that would, I knew one guy in particular and he lived in his van because he didn't want to get his kids sick.
You know, at the beginning, as we all remember, no one really knew anything. And we all thought we might die if we get it immediately. And so we were very cautious. the girls and I still laugh, like, remember when you wiped down all the groceries? Like, well, maybe we still should do that with the flu, but so we really stayed within our little bubble. My nephew actually joined us for a little while because he was at Purdue and he lives in California, so he kind of got booted out like all the other college students, and they weren't sure, like everyone, are you coming back? So we couldn't really fly to California and then come back in a couple of weeks. So he joined us. So that was a learning curve for all of us to have another teenager in the house.
I'm a early bird. So I might, if I had to go to the grocery store, I'd go at like 5 a.m. And of course, wearing masks. I remember wearing masks when it was like, we were the only ones wearing masks, and it felt really weird and almost silly to wear masks. Mm-hmm. Like, you go to Home Depot or something and you're the only one with a mask on, and I mean, life has changed now, but I remember being very early on feeling weird about all that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember just, I don't know, going grocery shopping, and you would get there and there would be nobody there. The whole place would be empty because everybody was quarantining pretty hardcore at that point. Mm-hmm. So that was just a really interesting, that was a really interesting time. And I remember going to get toilet paper. Remember when there's no toilet paper? We were legitimately out of toilet paper. I thought, oh, I can't find it. So I ended up going to Walmart. There was literally a fist fight going on in the toilet paper aisle. And I was like, oh, it's not worth it. No toilet paper here. Just, it was really crazy. So, yeah, I do remember some of that.
Memories that stand out.
I think I first learned about COVID pretty early on when it was still just an outbreak in China. I can't remember when that was, but I think around like October or November, I started hearing more about it. And I was just sort of wary. I didn't think it would be a big deal, but just as I could without stressing myself out. I do definitely remember having a growing concern all the way up to about February 2020. I remember meeting a friend for coffee. It was the first week of March in 2020. I was joked that we might not see each other again because of everything that was happening. But then shortly afterwards, things started shutting down and being very dramatic.
But I do remember there being a lot of, you know, I need COVID tests, or I'm looking for vaccines. Where do I get it? How do I, you know, where do I need to travel to get this? And some of them being very accessible at one day of the week, and then the next day of the week, they would be all gone, and you'd have to search again.
I remember feeling just so stressed all through the fall semester. The spring semester got better once we kind of settled into, we're doing the same thing. But I remember the combination of the uncertainty of what's happening with school and being a new foster parent, and trying to figure out how to parent two 17-year-olds in the middle of, can you have friends over or not? And even just them trying to make friends. They moved up here from further south in Indiana. So this is a whole new space for them. And them even trying to make friends in school when they're only in school a couple days a week and there's hardly any kids in the building. It was just really challenging for them to like settle in and make friends and kind of feel like they have space here.
But I remember when one of the college students said she was positive, and then we thought that she had infected the kids. So that's when we were like, can we have college students here? We can't have them running around. And they literally do. They come in for an hour. They might have been in three classrooms. Like tracking them, I was like, I don't think we can track them. Like, we can't have them here. And it was just awful because that is what we do. We have, I mean, the poor psychology students couldn't come in and do their labs, and the education students couldn't do their lessons. And then, I mean, and people, we paid college students. Some of them depend on it for their part of their livelihood. So it was a really tough decision for us, but it was like, we can't do that. We can't manage this. And then trying to be confidential. So how do you do that? Okay, well, this individual was in the 3s, 4s, 4, 5. Obviously, it wasn't another child. Then So that was the scary part where we were like, okay, this is out of control.
I think when I knew that I should take it seriously was, and I remember this day specifically, is I was talking to a friend her husband is a physician, and we were at gymnastics, and she said, I knew that I had to take it seriously when my husband took me to Costco and we started buying canned meat, because he was nervous enough to take it seriously. And then that very day, when I came home, I told my husband that story, and he goes, yeah, I think we better go to Costco right away. And for him to take it seriously, I was like, oh shit, this is going to get real. Like, this isn't just me and my anxiety. Like shit's about to get crazy here. So
at the very beginning of the pandemic, I was actually at Sanity Brunch with my friend, and we got the call. We were holding the conference at Notre Dame, and we got the call from Notre Dame, you know, everything's canceled. And so I spent the entire brunch apologizing to my friend while also being on the phone with like our keynote speakers from different parts of the country and different parts of the state saying, you know, we're so sorry. We know we have to cancel at the last minute. We hope that we can figure out a way to do this again. So that part kind of immediately fell away. And in fact, I remember my last restaurant meal before everything shut down was, the Thursday night, you know, of our spring break, I had taken my student teachers out for dinner. The student teachers are here on campus during St. Mary's spring break because they take the school spring break. And we are sitting at Fiddler's Hearth talking about what was happening. And they kept asking, do you think we're going to be able to finish student teaching? I said, I honestly don't know. You know, I have no answers for you. And so all of a sudden it went from me being, you know, here like 10 hours a day to not being here at all. And shifting everything to Zoom, so that was a pretty big change, and just, you know, kind of sitting in my house a lot during that time. And before then, I would, you know, while I say that my life is boring, I did like to go out and, you know, do work at the coffee shop or go to the library or do all these other things. And all of a sudden, that was completely gone as well.
It was a rough period in the beginning. Like, I couldn't find a thermometer anywhere. You know, that first 2 weeks, I had to watch them to make sure she didn't pass it on to them. And I remember, once again, I wasn't worried about myself, but I was watching them. And there wasn't a thermometer anywhere. I went to like 3-4 stores. I ended up finding like a baby one somewhere. I was like, this'll do. And then I couldn't find batteries, like the little batteries for it. It was like, I remember that particular night, it was very, very trying, you know? And, but the thing is, it's like, I couldn't unravel because they were watching me, you know, I really did. I wanted to, I was exhausted, you know? But they were like, eyes on Dad. You know, like how he handles it sets a precedent of how they're going to handle it.
What we'd notice.
I remember at times being remarkable. I mean, I'm white, and I remember being amazed that like 3/4 of my COVID ward would be black or Hispanic at any point, which is, that is very disproportionate for our community. I think a lot of it leads to, like, you know, multi-generational households. Poorer folks tend to get more people into a single housing arrangement. So there is times when I've taken care of a mom, dad, and their 2 kids are all and grandma are all in the COVID ward together. And I almost never saw that with white families. It was generally black and brown families. So I saw that a lot, and that was quite noticeable.
Yeah, the interesting thing, though, is within the LGBT community, we're actually at a higher rate of getting vaccines, mostly because we understand the value of vaccines. We understand that, you know, most of us have lived through a pandemic, and we called it AIDS. You know, it's still here, but we, you know, a lot of us still remember, you know, the devastation of the 80s, you know. So many people died of it, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, and, you know, how desperate the community was for any kind of medication to help with it. You know, so we're, we're a pretty motivated portion of the population to go and get those vaccines. I was in high school in the 90s. I remember when AZT came out, and we were the product of, if you have sex, you're going to die. You know, that was our sex ed. You know, it's like, you know, take care, you know, condom, condom, condom all the time, never without, you know, whereas now we've got, you know, younger generations where, you know, there's PrEP. You know, there's the ability to take something that can help prevent it even being transmitted to you, or, you know, if you are positive, you can be on medications to where it's nearly impossible for you to transmit it. So, you know, there's just this weird kind of 80s, 90s people who live through that, you know, they have a different take on, you know, sexuality and how we express that and how we live through that. And I do think that translates into how we approach other things like the pandemic.
We are still processing.
I know when I have a beautiful experience, I treasure that, because I do remember when we were all locked up, some more than others. and I think I hope that we all treasure each other and treasure the communal experiences we're allowed to have now that we know that there is an alternative to that.
Certainly this has been a generational or defining moment for all of us. Had its ups and downs. I think what's important for us to remember now when we look back on it in 10, 15, or 20 years is how much we didn't know, and we really were kind of making things up by the seat of our pants. You know, we knew that people were getting sick. We knew that people, especially those early months, knew that people were dying. And we didn't really know how virus really was spreading, or what were the means of transmission and whatnot. And so a lot of things might seem kind of a little silly in 50 years, or some of our responses might seem a little bit strange, but it's because we're working on the best data we had. And you know, we have come to know a lot about this virus in the past 2 years, and that certainly has changed the way we interact with it.
The World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a public health emergency of international concern on January 30th, 2020. On March 11th, 2020, the World Health Organization declared the COVID-19 outbreak a pandemic. On May 5th, 2023, the World Health Organization announced the end of its designation of COVID-19 as a public health emergency of international concern. On May 11th, 2023, the U.S. Federal Public Health Emergency Declaration for COVID-19 expired. As a community, we are still experiencing and learning to interact with COVID-19, and our memories of the early days of the pandemic are shifting. This oral history project and presentation were supported by a Council of Independent Colleges Humanities Research for the Public Good Sustaining Grant. Oral histories have been donated to the Civil Rights Heritage Center, where they are available as part of the center's archives.
South Bend's Own Words was created by Kevin Tidmarsh and me, George Garner. This episode was produced by Jamie Wagman and Julia Dower from St. Mary's College, along with Natalie Villalobos and me, from the Indiana University South Bend Civil Rights Heritage Center. See what's coming up next for us at crhc.usb.edu.